Lebanon has seen more than its share of war and hardship.
But nothing like this. Nothing like this.
1 year after that massive port explosion in Beirut, we look back at a trying time in Lebanon. Also ahead, in Pakistan, attacks on women get attention, but
the incidents which make it to social media, these are just tip of the iceberg.
And judo may come from Japan, but one nation in Europe showed up in Tokyo with competitors ready to put fear in their opponents.
Sort of like dancing. Dancing with somebody who's trying to kill you.
I'm Marco Werman, and two superfans burning the midnight oil to document Team Israel on social media. For them, it's not just about the podium.
We wanted to share the stories and the journeys of the athletes, whether or not they win a gold, silver, bronze, or they place 20th.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here. Tomorrow, Lebanon will mark a somber anniversary, 1 year since a massive explosion at the port of Beirut that killed more than 200 people. Thousands more were injured and displaced. Large sections of the Lebanese capital were leveled. It seemed to symbolize many overlapping dysfunctions in Lebanon, from the pandemic to one of the worst financial crises on earth, according to the World Bank, since the mid-19th century. From Beirut, Rebecca Collard has our story.
In a church about a mile from Beirut's port, a priest leads Sunday Mass. There are just a few dozen worshippers in the massive hall. The scars of the blast that destroyed this neighborhood 1 year ago still mark the church. Marble plaques shattered on the walls, stone columns cracked, and the church is still without windows. And the scars of the worshippers are much deeper. 20 members of this parish died that day. Father Ilya was giving a sermon as the blast ripped through his church. In the days after, he held funeral after funeral.
Every day for 2 weeks, I had, for example, three or four.
He says something that I have heard dozens of times from Lebanese over the past year.
I lived all the Lebanese wars, civil wars, all the wars, but nothing like this, nothing like this.
Outside the church, Father Elias shows me the graveyard. Even the dead were not safe from the hundreds of tons of ammonium nitrate that exploded in Beirut's port. When I was here 1 year ago, many of the graves in this cemetery had been blasted open by the explosion. The smell was thick and awful. The bones of those long deceased uncovered in their tombs. Father Elia buried the blast victims next to those open graves.
For example, this one, the owner didn't fix it.
It's still just kind of open. They just put this. Most of the graves have now been fixed or at least closed, but other repairs will have to wait. In the past year, Father Elia has had to make tough choices as inflation skyrocketed and poverty among his congregation rose dramatically. 6 days a week, the church hands out meals. Raja Hadwan began volunteering here 2 years ago, and she says since the blast, more and more people have come asking for food.
And everybody is needy, you know.
She says without the program, families would go hungry. Basic foodstuffs have tripled or even quadrupled in price since the economic crisis began in the fall of 2019. Salaries have not. And the pandemic meant many people lost their jobs. 50% of Lebanese are now believed to be below the poverty line. And Hedwan has just 100 meals a day. Every day, she has to turn people away.
We can't have more people, but the demand are growing.
On a chair, there's a pile of used children's clothes. Clothing has become impossibly expensive for many families, and pharmacies are running out of medicine. Outside, I run into Norma Irani. I met her the day after the blast, and like so many in this neighborhood, her home was destroyed. But she refused to leave and stayed in her doorless, windowless apartment without power. She invites me to come see her apartment now. On the way, we stop at what used to be her homeware shop.
We need money to buy the stocks.
But the stock comes from abroad, and Irani doesn't have the money to import it. Not that many people in her neighborhood have the money to buy it either.
No electricity now?
We climb the 4 flights of stairs to her apartment. The government is only providing 3 or maybe 4 hours of electricity per day. The generators can't keep up with the demand for the other 20 hours. And the fuel to run them has to be bought on the black market. Inside, the windows and doors are fixed, but the fridge is filled with donated food, bread, cheese, and vegetables.
This is from the association. They help us. And this one, this also. We cannot buy. Really.
Yeah.
So we need the
and
help.
Meat, you keep meat in the freezer, or are you worried
no,
about
No, 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 the freezer. Look, my freezer.
It's empty.
Yes, of course.
No meat, but Irani says she knows she's lucky. She has her home, and she's not going hungry. She says Lebanon badly needs help, but...
Only the people. Only. Not the government. Not at all.
Back at the church, Father Ilya says his congregation needs hope. So many like Irani have no faith in their government or their leaders, and for good reason.
They have to trust the future of their country. And even now, we don't have it. So we are preparing ourselves to the worst. You see, we are still in the darkness.
A year after the blast, Lebanese leaders still haven't formed a new government. A government needed to make reforms and meet the conditions of the international community, to unlock billions in badly needed aid and loans. And in the meanwhile, Lebanon sinks deeper into crisis. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Tomorrow, a year after the Beirut explosion, the story of Lebanese families who are still seeking justice. A decade ago, the Syrian uprising was sparked in the southern city of Deraa, then spread throughout the country. In the past 10 years, the government of President Bashar al-Assad has either defeated or pacified many of Syria's rebel forces. But now Deraa is seeing worsening violence again. Abdullah al-Jabassini is a Syrian researcher with the Middle East Institute in Vienna. I asked him what sparked the uptick in violence in Deraa.
So basically, in June 2021, the state imposed a tight siege on the old part of Deraa city. The siege resulted from locals' rejection to a demand made by a newly appointed Russian officer to surrender the light firearms and allow the state to search the area and erect checkpoints. Few days after a month-long siege, the state began a major military push in Deraa al-Balad. Intense clashes broke out as unreconciled rebels clashed with the Iranian lenient 4th Division of the Syrian Army. During these clashes, the state military used artillery, tank fire, rockets, marking the deadliest and most intense fighting in Syria's southwest since the 2018 reconciliation agreements were concluded.
So that's a background. Since 2018, there was an agreement that had been in place that drew down the violence in Deraa. Was that the plan developed by the Russian you mentioned?
Well, basically, in June 2018, when the Syrian army deployed its forces to the southern fronts, Russia brokered negotiations between rebel leaders and state representatives in a few cities. Based on the outcomes of these reconciliation negotiations, dissolved rebel groups had to surrender their heavy weapons. However, the individual former rebels were allowed to keep possession of their light arms. Now, for the past 3 years, Russia remained committed to the core agreement, or to the core of this agreement, which is to intervene and limit the presence of the state's military and security forces in parts of the south.
So what happened to the Russian brokered agreement?
Now, the Russians are trying to intervene. Whenever such escalations or military offensives happen, the Russians try to intervene and to mediate to diffuse tensions. The Russians would like or are craving to maintain the status quo they built in 2018. This is a guarantee, at least for the Russians vis-a-vis the neighboring countries, that the Iranian influence would be limited in southern Syria.
So apparently a Russian delegation was in Deraa city yesterday. What role is Russia playing in all of this now, and what's at stake for Russia?
I think the Russians are trying to implement ceasefires. But despite all of these ceasefires, the Russians are faced with Iranian actor that is trying to act as a spoiler for any ceasefire. The state officials who are close to the Iranians do not want this status quo in southern Syria. The state will not tolerate any rebellious fears anymore. And despite the nominal control that the state suffers in parts of the south, the state is a core actor that will continue maneuvering to bring these reconciliation areas under its firm security grip.
Just in terms of optics, it is kind of remarkable. Daraa is the birthplace of the Syrian uprising. What do you think it says about the state of things in Syria that the province where the uprising broke out is now taking up arms against the regime?
I think the escalation is indicative of the inability of the Assad regime and the opposition-leaning communities to reconcile their fundamental differences. While the Syrian regime's deep-rooted security-focused mentality has survived the war seemingly unscathed. After a decade of war, people still demand a change in Syria. They are not willing to accept the rule of Bashar al-Assad anymore.
So that's what I wanted to know. Is there a path forward in Daraa or even a ceasefire between the rebels and the regime? Or do you think the situation there is just indicative of how Syria could just lurch forward with these outbursts of violence?
I think a ceasefire largely depends on Russia now and its ability to prevent Iran from acting as a spoiler. In other words, Russia does operate to diffuse tensions and maintain a three-year-old status quo in Syria's south. Iran, on the other hand, appears to want to undermine the established order. The military offensive, or whatever has been happening in Dar al-Balad, and despite the multiple ceasefires and the Russian conciliatory intervention, is not over yet. I think the situation across southern Syria remains very tense. It remains subject to rapid change.
Abdullah al-Jabassini is a Syrian researcher with the Middle East Institute, speaking with us from Vienna about the worsening violence in Daraa province. Abdullah, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Okay, spoiler alert for those of you who are watching the Olympics at home in the evening. Come back to us in 90 seconds. For the rest of you, this evening in Tokyo, all eyes are on a teenage track star.
She's going to create history for the United States, their first champion in half a century.
19-year-old Ah-Thing Mo took gold in the 800 meters, the first time the U.S. has claimed the top spot in this event since the 1968 games in Mexico City. As if that wasn't enough, Mo also snagged a new American record. Back home in a large room in Trenton, New Jersey, a pandemic-era Olympic scene we're quickly becoming familiar with. Jubilation from a viewing party back home. You can hear Al Jennings there, who has coached Mo since she was 9. Mo was born to South Sudanese parents who moved to the U.S. just before she was born in New Jersey. Before the games, her brother told the New York Times, quote, "When you are from an immigrant family that comes in with its back against the wall, you know what the bottom is." He continued, "It gives us a focus on pursuing things that would help us improve our lives." For Ah-Thing Mo, that focus was running. Before heading off to Tokyo, she shared her hopes on her YouTube channel.
I just want to be an Olympic gold medalist, to be completely honest. So I'm just looking forward to that. And hopefully that comes, God willing.
That hard work paid off today at just 19 years young. One footnote, the podium featured none of the medalists from the 2016 Summer Games in Rio. That's because women with naturally high testosterone are now banned from the 800 meters if they don't take medication to lower their levels. That rule disqualified all three of the reigning medalists. More stories from the Olympic Games coming up, including France's love affair with judo, plus superfans of Team Israel. That's later this hour. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. He left his home in Belarus for his political views and found safety in Kiev, the capital of neighboring Ukraine. But after going out for his morning run yesterday, Vitaly Shishov went missing. Today, he was found dead in a park near his home in Kiev. Ukrainian police say they have launched a criminal investigation for suspected murder, masked as suicide. Shishov was the director of the Belarusian House in Ukraine, a group that helps Belarusians fleeing from political persecution. Tadeusz Chomich knew Shishov. Chomich is a Kiev-based doctor and, like Shishov, also from Belarus. He joins us from Kiev. Tadeusz Chomich, what was your reaction when you heard about the death of Vitaly Shishov?
I knew Vitaly while going to our common Belarusian activities. I can say that this person has made a lot of good things for our Belarusian immigrants, especially for people who lived in Belarus practically without nothing. Such things as housing, material help in a new place, and helping with work, psychological help were presented. I can say that he was an honest, brave, and humble person. So I think it's a big loss, not only for Belarusians in Ukraine, but also for our country in general.
So my understanding is that there is a large Belarusian community in Ukraine. What is that community like in Kyiv? And since those anti-Lukashenko protests last summer in Minsk, how has that Belarusian community in Kyiv changed?
As I have migrated to Kyiv in the beginning of 2019, yes, I knew only two, three people from Belarus who were living in Kyiv. After August, the life in diaspora has changed dramatically. For me, I have met here a lot of brave people from Belarus. And a lot of people from Belarus were forced to move for various different reasons. Some made this consciously because they haven't seen the future for themselves and for their children. And others were forced to leave the country because of the political persecution connected with their civil position.
Tadeusz, what about you? Why did you decide to move to Kyiv in 2019, and how has your life changed since then?
So I was born in Minsk, and after graduation from the medical university, I got to work in one of Minsk state clinics. And after working there for some years, I decided to went to Kyiv and to continue my practice here. Here, doctors can find a lot of perspectives and begin to walk in a modern way.
Tadeusz, do you consider yourself an activist on behalf of Belarusians there in Kyiv, in Ukraine?
I'm not an official member of any organization, but also I attend actions and other activities when I have free time. For example, every Sunday in Kyiv, we have an action for supporting different professions, for example, who suffered from the behavior of Belarusian government.
Given your own activism, Tadeusz, do you feel safe in Kyiv?
Really, I can say that I feel here safe, because you can walk here, you can do practically all that you want. But I'm also very surprised that these people who have killed Vitaly can go to Ukraine free. So some activists, of course, can't feel very safe now, because nobody expected that it will be so.
Again, we do not know how Mr. Shishov died. Kyiv police are investigating. Tadeusz Homich is a Kyiv-based doctor, originally from Minsk, the capital of Belarus, speaking with us about the death of Belarusian activist Vitaly Shishov in Kyiv. Tadeusz, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
The Tokyo Olympics have been filled with upsets. Japanese tennis superstar Naomi Osaka was knocked out early. There were the Canadian women who took down Team USA in soccer. Ouch. And Italian sprinter Marcel Jacobs perplexing the odds makers, coming out of nowhere to win the 100-meter dash and the title of world's fastest human. But stop the presses on this one. France beating host Japan at its own game. The French judo team took gold in the first ever mixed event in Olympic history. Reporter Rebecca Rossman was not surprised by this. She checked in from Paris, explaining why.
August may be the official start of France's summer holidays, but this judo training center on the southern edge of Paris is staying open. Tonight, it's at max capacity.
Le dojo, le petit dojo, et il y a un grand, grand dojo.
Instructor Raymond Demonier shows me the dojo, a rectangular mat that takes up most of the floor space.
Alors, je serais incapable de vous dire pourquoi, mais ce sport.
Demonier says, I can't explain why, but France has always excelled at judo, which is good for us, he says. A group of 40 men of all ages pair up and begin the first exercise. Almost all these men are black belts. Their goal? Pin their opponent to the ground using precision and power. Or as this man puts it.
So it's sort of like dancing, dancing with somebody who's trying to kill you.
That's Sebastian Smith, a journalist based in D.C. who gave up a part of his Paris vacation to train here.
I was here last week, and I'm still aching from then. So everybody here is at a higher level than me.
With nearly 600,000 registered players, or judokas, across the country, judo is one of France's most popular sports. How that happened may be somewhat of a mystery, but a lot of credit is given to French parents, who are attracted to the sport's strict moral code that teaches 8 values, including respect, modesty, and self-control.
But you learn to respect your opponent. Your opponent is, before being your opponent, he is your friend.
34-year-old instructor Romain Pousson estimates 80% of French kids have at least dabbled in judo.
For every children, it's a very good sport. I'm the first to advise parents to put their children in judo, but till 10 years old. After, it's better to let them choose what they want to do.
Those that do choose to stick with it have some of the best coaches in the world. Pousson sent 2 of his students to this year's summer games. One of them has already taken home a silver medal. Overall, France won 8 judo medals, including 2 golds, and delivered a shocking upset to Japan on its home turf. They were given a hero's welcome when they returned to Paris. The most recognized player, Teddy Riner, took home a gold and a bronze medal, making him the highest medal earner in judo history. Back on the dojo in Paris, there's a young athlete training to beat that record.
Le fait de gagner des compétitions, ça donne envie.
Kayla Issoufi, only 20 years old, says she trains here 8 or 9 times a week in hopes of winning a gold medal on her home turf when Paris hosts the Games in 2024. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
China will conduct mass coronavirus testing in the city of Wuhan after a recent increase in cases of the Delta variant there, and no transportation in or out of Wuhan either. Learn more at theworld.org/Instagram. You're listening to The World. After months of deadlock, the island nation of Samoa finally has a new government with the country's first female prime minister. Many are angered it took so long to make it official.
Women continue to fight this struggle despite all of the qualifications.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 30 years ago, a shooting in the nation's capital started an uprising. A Salvadoran man was shot by police in Washington's Mount Pleasant neighborhood, about 3 miles north of downtown D.C. The area is also known as La Mamplesa. The shooting led first to anger, then to a dialogue about police brutality and racism. As The World's Daisy Contreras reports, former residents are now taking steps to make sure future generations don't forget what happened.
4 men stand on a city plaza in Washington, D.C., on the corner of Mount Pleasant and Lamont Streets. They have instruments, a guitar, a hand drum. One holds a piece of paper with a poem on it. They look behind them toward the intersection.
Remember, you were over here,
right? Yeah, we were right there when the riot started, bro. We heard the shots, man.
All of this is a scene from La Manplesa, an uprising remembered. The documentary centers around a Salvadoran man who was shot at this intersection. Daniel Gomez was drunk, and officers thought he had a knife. Some people said he didn't. Despite that, officers shot and badly injured him. For 2 nights, youth clashed with police.
Police are on foot. Sounds like tear gas going off, and I just hope we can survive.
The film's producer, Kike Aviles, lived there. He's a poet, activist, and performer who fled El Salvador during the Civil War. He says La Manplesa is not just a place. It lives in people's memories, even 30 years later.
There was a lot of damage done to police cars. I don't know how many of them, but it was just everything was on fire. Cops got injured, but nobody died. Nobody died.
He was 21 when the demonstrations began. For years before that, the police harassed the mainly immigrant and Black communities. And those communities were friendly with each other. But the frustration with policing exploded the night Gomez was shot. Aviles says what followed was organized resistance that had an impact.
The story is not really being taken into account, and it's time for us to change that.
There were some positive changes after the uprising, says Sammy Miranda. He's a poet and an artist. He also used to live in Mount Pleasant. The city's leaders realized the community had different needs, so there were more Spanish-speaking police officers hired and more money towards services for Latinos. Finally, he says, they felt seen. But that progress wasn't sustained, and that feeling was lost. Today, Miranda says,
El racismo existe en todo lado.
Racism exists everywhere because people allow it to.
We need to see that we can be part of the problem, right? And until we start seeing the role we play as part of the problem, then we won't understand the role we have in changing the situation.
Divisions even within the community and not supporting each other hold them back, Miranda says. The film's director, Ellie Walton, lived in the neighborhood and was 9 when the shooting happened. She says it's important to learn from these cycles of frustration and progress. We need to learn how events connect in history in order to sustain progress, she says.
So to connect the war in El Salvador to the over-policing on the streets of Mount Pleasant to, you know, what's happening today with George Floyd, with Black Lives Matter. And I think it's connecting these dots to show the systemic oppression.
Today, Walton says Mount Pleasant faces gentrification. Soaring rents have pushed many former residents out, and many of the incoming residents don't know what happened there in the past.
You know, if we don't look back and we don't, like, honor the history that is under our feet, like, I wonder how we can actually create real change.
In the film, Kike Aviles with two musicians, Lilo Gonzalez and Pepe Gonzalez, stand at a plaza in Mount Pleasant. They play for Sammy Miranda.
Home. When it's time to leave it all behind, discard button, bead, or bobble.
They're using art, poetry, and music to teach people about what happened at that intersection and how a community was changed.
Leave all things unfamiliar, but be sure not to miss the boat.
For the world, I'm Daisy Contreras.
People are moving. Migratory birds in flight. Many immigrants land in a city of so many places. Everyone, sooner or later, finds one special they name home.
Politics in the Polynesian nation of Samoa don't make a lot of headlines, but what's going on there right now suggests we should pay attention. 3 months after a general election and a constitutional crisis, Samoa finally has a new government. Recent months saw a deadlock between two candidates claiming to be the elected prime minister, the incumbent, who'd been in charge for more than 20 years, and his opponent, the candidate who would end up becoming Samoa's first woman prime minister, Fiamme Naomi Maataofa. The ruling by the Samoan court paved the way for the first political turnover there in more than 4 decades. As Ashley Westerman reports, a crisis may be over, but many Samoans are wondering how to avoid a similar situation in the future.
Samoa's new prime minister has been busy. Since taking office last week, Fiamme, the leader of the new ruling party known as FAST, has installed a government, canceled a controversial $1 million Chinese-funded port project, and tried to start healing the wounds left in the wake of the constitutional crisis. Longipoiva Sherelle Jackson is an independent Samoan journalist who's watched and covered the political drama.
It's been a variety of feelings of shock, surprise. There's been moments of sheer celebration and happiness.
It had all the makings of a Hollywood political drama. Razor-thin election results, longtime rulers clinging to power, highly politicized court rulings, politicians being locked out of buildings, the list goes on. All overlaid with the fact that Samoa was on the precipice of having its first female leader ever.
But then as it dragged on longer, Just as we were feeling that there couldn't be any more surprising obstacles in the way of a woman rising to leadership, more and more obstacles were put in her way.
Now the situation seems to be resolved. And while relieved, Sherelle Jackson warns,
it's important to note that it's far from over.
The previous prime minister, who was ousted by the appeals court, has now moved into an opposition figure role and continues to criticize the court's decision to have him vacate the office. On Monday, hundreds of people paraded through the streets of the capital of Pia in support of him and his party, the Human Rights Protection Party. Decrying what they call a disintegration of their constitution, the demonstrators demanded the resignation of various judges involved in confirming FIAMA to power. One of FIAMA's priorities while in office is avoiding this kind of situation from happening again. Experts say there are many things that could be addressed, including adding constitutional safeguards to better uphold the rule of law, as well as changing the number of members in parliament and looking at revising a broad constitutional provision that guarantees a certain level of female representation in government. Damon Salesa is an associate professor of Pacific Studies at the University of Auckland. He says a change to the role of head of state, which is separate from the prime minister, will likely be needed as well.
And actually, it's very challenging in Samoa because of the level of respect and deference that Samoans pay to someone who's known as a tamainga, who inhabits the head of state role.
The mostly ceremonial position is chosen from a group of very important chiefs in Samoa.
That means they have to be treated with an enormous respect. And that's what made this all very challenging, because no one felt comfortable openly criticizing the current holder of the position.
Among other controversial moves, the current head of state is the one who initially declared that FIAMA's government could not be formed after the general elections in April and called for new elections, triggering the constitutional crisis. Salesa, who is Samoan himself, says there's a tendency to default to traditional authority amid a culture of great patience and civility that may have kept the crisis from becoming violent. But, he says, there may also be a deeper conflict between traditional and democratic ways. Journalist Longi Poiva Sherelle Jackson says during this crisis, she learned a lot about Samoan loyalty to chiefs, tribes, villages, and communities.
And that it was very dangerous, because translating this kind of tribal-like behavior to modern democratic systems is unhealthy.
Still, for Sherelle Jackson, the most disturbing aspect of the last few months is that FIAMA was denied leadership at all.
Women continue, in the Pacific, continue to fight this struggle despite all of their qualifications and all of the work they put into place so that they could rise to power.
And that, she says, will continue to be an issue for Samoa and the region. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
Israel has sent its largest ever Olympic team to the Games in Tokyo, 90 athletes competing in 15 sports. If you're a fan, it's a lot to keep up with. But thanks to two longtime superfans in Israel, the athletes' stories are being told. David Wiseman and Shari Wright-Pilo run a social media account called Follow Team Israel, where they report the latest Israeli sports news in English. David and Shari, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Follow Team Israel seems to be really about the love of sport. I was scrolling through the feed, Sherry, and it's clear you post about athletes no matter how well they do. You're really posting about their journeys, the pride in the country's athletes, and not just the scores. Is that a reflection of you or of how Israelis see their team?
I think it's a reflection of David and I. I think we decided at the very beginning that was our main purpose, was to share the stories and the journeys of the athletes, whether or not they win a gold, silver, bronze, or they place 20th. They worked hard to get to any competition, to be on the field, to be in the court. And we wanted to share those stories with people.
I mean, it's so great to recognize the hard work. David, how have Israeli athletes responded to the stories you're telling?
They really love it because a lot of them are in niche sports, such as judo, gymnastics, sailing, sports that really don't get any mainstream coverage outside of the Olympics. And so it's also important that sort of they're kept on people's radars throughout the 4 years and not just at the Olympics. And on top of that, when they don't do well, that's the time when they really need our support because of how much they're hurting.
So you post athlete updates year-round, but I can imagine when the Olympics land, it gets really busy for you. David, you've actually taken these 2 weeks off of work to tend to the account. How hectic is your life right now? You also have to watch the games every day. How many hours are you working on this?
There's a six-hour time difference between Tokyo and Israel. They're ahead. So waking up around 4 a.m. and then sort of posting it as the day goes, which normally finishes around sort of 3.
I mean, have you gotten a sense from your followers what these Olympians and these moments you're documenting, what they all mean to Israel?
It's interesting because a lot of our fans might not necessarily be judo fans, or they might not necessarily be track fans, but they're so excited to see Israeli athletes on, you know, the world's largest playing field. And it excites everybody from all over the world, from the Philippines, from United States, Canada, Britain. I think we have 100 different countries of people following us. We have people following us from Iran, fans of Israel.
Wow. David, what's been your favorite moment so far?
During the opening ceremony, for the first time, the IOC actually recognized the 11 murdered athletes at the 1972 Olympics with a moment's silence, which sort of, because of their sort of recalcitrance over the years to do that, it actually took a lot of people by surprise that they did do that. So I think for many, that's a moment from the games that will really sort of linger, and, you know, far bigger than sport.
No doubt. As long as we have you, give us the insider view on these 90 Israeli athletes. Who should we be watching in Tokyo? Do you have a favorite competitor?
We don't have a favorite competitor. You know, we love them all equally. But there are a number of great medal opportunities in the second week, especially in gymnastics and also in marathon. So some potential, and we're very excited about how they'll do in these remaining days.
David Wiseman and Shari Wright-Pilo run the social media account Follow Team Israel, where they report Israeli sports news in English. You can find them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. David, Shari, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Marco.
Thank you very much, Marco.
That's the sound of the dundun, or talking drum. The percussion is common in certain West African music. The hourglass-shaped dundun also functions as a sort of language substitute. It replicates the tones and patterns of Yoruba, the West African language spoken by more than 40 million people. Cecilia Durojaye is a Nigerian musicologist and researcher who studies this. She joins us from Frankfurt, Germany. I guess you can argue, Cecilia, all music is a form of communication, but the dundun, or talking drum, kind of is even more like a voice box. How is the player able to change the pitch?
The musicians, they're able to manipulate the strings on the face of the drum to actually imitate the language. That is easy to do because the language that is being imitated is a tonal language. So the drummers are able to think in terms of tones.
You sent along three samples of the dundun. I'd like us to listen to them. The first one is, it's a straight-on song. And this one is a dundun imitating speech. So for my ear, I can't really tell the difference. What was being communicated in that second excerpt where the dundun is imitating speech? What does that mean?
Something like the belly is the father of all gods. The belly needs food. One has to feed it. So the drum, we do exactly the same number of phrases or number of syllables that the sentence has, okay? So like the one I said now, Ajima tokunje ikumbaba orisha. That is about Ajima tokunje ikumbaba orisha. That's about 11 syllables or so. And that is exactly what the drum will do as well.
Finally, here's a dundun playing a dance rhythm. Well, obviously he's going to get us to move. But what do you hear in that dance rhythm that's different from the dundun imitating speech, Cecilia?
I know the language, so I can hear the difference. But one thing that is actually very, very obvious will be the rhythm, because the rhythm of the music is regular. Speech is irregular. So when we hear the difference between the two, also one is playing the rhythm of the music. For someone who knows how to listen to African music, will feel that groove, a feel of movement, like, okay, I can move to this, I can dance to this. But the one for speech is not like that. So that is the obvious difference between the two.
I'm curious, since you kind of know this talking drum language, have you ever communicated in kind of percussion with a friend to kind of keep a secret, for example?
Personally, no. But I know that drummers, they do that in their household. You know, I was in Nigeria living with some of these drummers, actually, I lived with them for like 8 months. Mm. They would drum something and then a child would come, bring water or something. And then I realized that they were actually using the drum to communicate within the household, to tell themselves something or another. And then sometimes one of them would just tell me that he said this, she said that. And I was like, oh, okay, I don't know that, you know.
So, Cecilia, let me get deep here. Since you're the researcher, do you have any idea what came first, the sound of the dundun or the sound of Yoruba?
I would think that the Yoruba language comes first. And there are some people who argue that maybe the drum actually was brought into Yoruba land or to Africa, maybe from Arabian countries or something like that. If that is the case, then Yoruba exists before the drum.
Cecilia Durojaye is a Nigerian musicologist and researcher who studies the musical practices of unknown and underrepresented cultures. We've been talking about the linguistic properties of the talking drum. Cecilia, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael.
It is a story that's become all too familiar for many women around the globe. Cross the wrong man, lose your life. The recent brutal murder of a 27-year-old daughter of a former diplomat has sparked outrage in Pakistan. The alleged assailant is the son of a powerful business tycoon. This week, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan tried to reassure the country.
Look, this is Noor's case. I'm following it from the first day.
He said that the people who killed the woman, Noor Mukaddam, no matter how powerful they are, will not escape full punishment. But many Pakistanis say justice in the case is unlikely. That Mukaddam story is all too common.
She was, like many women of Pakistan, would say she was just another young, educated, elite woman of Pakistan who would have never thought that domestic abuse or honor killing can be her story.
That's Gulalay Ismail, a women's rights advocate who fled Pakistan after her life was threatened. She says she thinks Noor Mukaddam was murdered because she rejected the advances of Zahir Zakir Jaffer.
Unfortunately, because she spoke up for herself, and as per the news, because she broke up with her ex, she refused to marry her, he killed her. So I would say she is just another young woman of Pakistan who became a victim to misogyny and patriarchy.
She's the youngest daughter of a former Pakistani diplomat, so one of the country's elites. How did Noor Mukaddam die?
She was tortured. She was beheaded. She was killed brutally by Zahid Jaffer, who had kept her hostage in his house.
So these are the charges against the alleged killer, Mr. Jaffer, the son of a business tycoon, another elite. And this happened in the capital, Islamabad. Have you heard reaction from the country's political class and Islamabad's elites?
There is a lot of uproar. For days, Noor Mukaddam, justice for Noor Mukaddam, was trending. There were protests in Islamabad. There was even a protest in New York. And in many parts of the world, there was protest against her beheading.
So Noor Mukaddam's murder comes just a few days after the daughter of Afghanistan's top envoy in Islamabad was abducted. These incidents have received a lot of attention, it seems, because of the profile of the families involved. So how unusual is this violence against women in Pakistan today?
Violence against women is not unusual in Pakistan. Just a day before Noor Mukaddam was killed, another woman named Kurutalain, she was killed by her husband. She was a mother of four. She was brutally beaten and tortured by her husband and killed. Similarly, there was another woman, a police constable killed his wife in another city in Peshawar. So I believe that the incidents which make it to social media, these are just tip of the iceberg. The issue is much more complicated. Just a few days before Noor Mukaddam was killed, there was legislation against domestic abuse in the parliament. And when a bill was passed against domestic abuse, there was uproar against why a bill has been passed against domestic abuse. It is going to destroy our family system. And the government, the prime minister, then because of the public pressure of certain segments in the society, the prime minister of Pakistan referred the bill to the Islamic Ideology Council of Pakistan. And we have seen that this current government, the political participation of women has been reduced as well. There are fewer women ministers. And this is an example that how this government does not take lives of women seriously. Before this current government, Pakistan was actually improving for women. The current government has actually reversed everything that was done by the previous governments. It is true that violence against women is not new in Pakistan. But what is new is that the government has no political will to protect women of Pakistan. It has never happened in the history of Pakistan that a sitting prime minister would blame rape victims for getting raped.
Gulale, you come to this horrific story of Noor Mukaddam with your own experience of gender violence. You're a critic of the Pakistani government, and you managed to flee in 2019 despite being hunted down by Pakistan's security services. They deployed undercover agents, threatened and abducted family friends to extract information. Why were they so determined to apprehend you? What did you say?
I was a vocal woman who was speaking about human rights, and this regime is afraid of vocal women. This government does not want women who speak truth to the power, who speak about the human rights abuses, who speak about the war crimes happening, because they are afraid that if women are part of social uprising, if women are part of social movements, if women are part of political movements, then their status quo will not be maintained anymore. And when I started raising the issue of sexual harassment in the war on tribal areas of Pakistan, that is when the government doubled down their persecution of me. So they're really afraid of women's issues being highlighted and women being part of the social movement.
As we speak, you're not in Pakistan. How concerned are you about the long arms of the Pakistani security services, the ISI?
There is an increasing evidence that the military establishment of Pakistan is going after the dissidents who are living in exile. There is actually a case in the UK where someone has been arrested for conspiring murder of a dissident of Pakistan named Waqas Ghorayya. So in my case, my parents, who are still in Pakistan, they are being persecuted. They are not allowed to leave the country, and they have to go to the court almost on a daily basis. My father has been repeatedly being imprisoned in Pakistan despite his really poor health. So both of my parents are being judicially persecuted, and they have been denied from coming and joining their children in the United States.
Gulala, you've spent many years calling attention to rapes and disappearances and abuse of Pakistani women. The story of Noor Mukaddam involves some of the most elite families in Islamabad, as you said. How hopeful are you that this tragic incident will start the conversation in Pakistan about ending violence against women once and for all?
I'm really afraid that nothing will change. When it comes to murder of women, men enjoy impunity. The legal structure, the judicial system, the government, the state institutions have failed to bring an end to the impunity against honor killing, against murdering of women.
I'm a little surprised to hear you use the phrase honor killing. I mean, it's essentially murder, isn't it?
It's murder, yeah. However, we use the word honor killing because in Pakistan, legally, murder is a crime against person, not against the state. And for honor killing, we have been actually able to at least bring change in the law that when it is mentioned in the legal case, then the matter cannot be settled out of the court. And it also brings more light to the fact that honor is actually another term for misogyny, which is getting women killed. And how screwed up the concept of honor is in Pakistan. It's actually killing in the name of misogyny. It's actually killing in the name of patriarchy.
We leave you today with those brave words of defiance. That was Gulale Ismail, a Pakistani human rights activist and founder of the advocacy group Aware Girls, speaking with us about the killing of a young woman in Islamabad. A hard story to hear, but one we need to hear. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. From PR.